This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Jane Hill. Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 31st of October. Spain is in 3 days of national mourning following the devastation wrought by torrential rain and flash flooding. I've been speaking to one resident helping with the relief effort who says she's never seen anything like it, and to a Green MP in Valencia. The US has confirmed thousands of North Korean troops are now in the Kursk region of Russia. What will this mean for Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine? And the portrait of the computer scientist Alan Turing that's been created by an AI robot. Is it really art? I've been talking to the robot's developer. The scenes in eastern Spain following Tuesday night's torrential rain and flash flooding have been catastrophic. Bridges washed away, rail links down, thick layers of mud everywhere. Some districts are still cut off, meaning the bodies of those killed can't be retrieved. At least 158 people are known to have died, most in the Valencia region, and that number will rise. More than 1,200 rescue workers have been deployed, but some residents have accused the authorities of not being prepared and say there should have been earlier warnings to leave. This woman, Rosa, told the BBC what it was like when the floodwaters arrived in her area on the outskirts of Valencia.
It was something that we couldn't expect because this place never gets flooded. But this time it has rained so much that the water from the river has overflowed and came all down here. So it was like suddenly we get messages saying the water is coming, the water is coming. And then police say, get your cars out of the garages. All people get the cars, get out, go to other villages on the streets, on places where you think they might be safe. But the water came very, very fast. Some people was in this street with a car. I'm not sure if everybody get off the car.
Well, the situation on the ground has made the rescue of survivors possible only by helicopter in some areas. In the Valencian suburb of Paporta, one local resident, Mark, told the BBC that bodies were still being found.
I just got a message that a couple of streets from us, they found 8 bodies in the parking lot that is underground. Probably people trying to save their cars and get out of the parking lot as soon as possible, but fortunately they didn't make it.
Well, earlier today, the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez visited some of the devastated areas. He warned that the emergency was far from over and said the authorities were committed to finding people who were still unaccounted for.
We want to express our solidarity once again with the victims and their relatives. I also want to convey the commitment of the Spanish government and all the emergency services, our commitment by land, air and sea, by all the means and for as long as necessary, with all the resources to find the missing people.
Well, let's talk first of all to the BBC's Andrew Harding, who is in Valencia tonight. Andrew, the scenes are horrific, very distressing. Just give us your sense. Tell us what you've been seeing and what you've been hearing there.
Good evening, Jane. It is indeed extraordinarily grim scene here in some of the suburbs and villages and towns around Valencia. We've been that view that we've seen on screens from other parts of the world, thick mud, bridges down, rubbish sort of caught up against the side of buildings. I've seen cars piled on top of each other in some streets where the water just became so powerful that it kind of turned these streets into scrap metal yards almost. And people now, we've seen them wading through the retreating floodwaters, some of them with sort of makeshift boots on, plastic bags wrapped around legs, people carrying their bags. A lot of people also, as you mentioned there, expressing frustration, saying we were really only given a proper level of warning when it was already too late. It's clear that somehow the authorities here need to improve their warnings and make people react more quickly to find higher ground. One thing people have remarked is that there wasn't any rain here. It was rain inland in the mountains. And so perhaps people didn't take it as seriously as they should have done because it didn't feel it felt a bit remote, I suppose, on Tuesday afternoon. And then suddenly the waters were on them. The internet is intermittent here. We've seen a lot of people struggling for water and for food. So, yeah, pretty grim. We know a lot of soldiers, a lot more soldiers are on their way to help with the relief effort. And we've seen signs of the recovery efforts in some areas, but also frustrated people saying to us, we feel neglected. We've had no help. No rescue workers have reached us.
There's that. And then a quick thought, Andrew, about the longer term as well. I mean, the recovery will take so long. Where are people going to live? Who's going to pay for this?
It will take a long time. This is a wealthy country. I'm sure they'll manage that. To me, the bigger issue is the fact that unlike, say, Japan or Indonesia, which are used to natural disasters and used to preparing communities to handle them, clearly the messaging here, the education here, is not there. And it's, I think, a wake-up call, not just for Spain, but for, you know, all of Europe as we start to see these more extreme weather patterns caused by climate change.
Indeed, Andrew Harding, thank you so much. Well, I've been talking to Inma, who's a secondary school teacher in the town of Utiel to the west of Valencia. She spoke to me from a public building where people who've lost their homes are now having to sleep. And she told me about the volunteer relief effort that she's involved with.
We have hundreds of items of clothing that we're trying to organise as well as we can. People have lost everything. At the same time, we also see the best side of people because lots of the children are coming to help us organise the clothes and everybody's trying to collaborate. So shame that it has to be because of this.
And where are you taking everything that you have gathered together? Where are people even sleeping?
Well, this is like a social centre. It's got three floors. Downstairs is what we are. It's an open space area. It's got two more floors upstairs. And where I am at the moment, I can see blankets on the floor for people who are going to sleep here tonight. Firefighters, volunteers of all kinds who have come from areas around Utiel. So I can see that they've already been set up on the floor. The heating's on, so we look because we haven't had electricity. And well, where I have my own place, I haven't had hot water for 3 days. There is hot water here, so they will have everything they need to at least try to rest for the night. I was talking to a friend's dad who is 93 and he hasn't either. I mean, yes, the torrential rain sometimes in autumn, but not like this.
Are people saying, why was there no warning?
The priority now is to help people who are in need, but it will have to be dealt with when this finishes because we didn't know that it was going to be so bad. I mean, but yes, apparently the official authorities did have that information. I mean, I think that with the technical means that we have, can't be that difficult. I mean, something of this magnitude to predict it, I don't know. But I mean, I'm not an expert, but surely, I'm a teacher at secondary school, and at 7 in the morning, we were told not to go to work because the lessons were cancelled. But I've heard of people who work in warehouse states and in places where they had to get to work. They were not given that option to stay at home and not go to work. Something should have been done before.
You say, Inma, you've never seen anything like it in your lifetime.
No.
And you've described well the massive practical problems facing people. But are people also traumatised from what they've seen?
I don't know. I mean, so lucky not to know what they think, but I guess that they're just so traumatized, but not aware of how traumatized they are. They're so focused on cleaning off, on dealing with it as well as they can and as quickly as possible that when that is finished, that's when they will really be aware of what's happened. But I was giving that friends of mine. This is a small town, like 10,000 people only. I've got lots of friends here. I've lived here for 20 years. So I had to deliver food and drink to close friends of mine who've lost everything. I could see the inside of their living room because the whole wall's come off like a doll's house. You can see the inside.
Do you worry about climate change? Do you have anxiety about this happening again?
Like I said before, I'm 53. This old man I was talking to before, 93, and it's never happened. I mean, yes, natural disasters do take place, of course, but this is something else. I mean, this is different. I don't know. Like I said, I'm a teacher. I'm not an expert at all, but we are doing something wrong. I mean, that is for certain. There is something that has changed in the last few decades.
Inma there, talking about her experiences and those of her friends and neighbours. I've also been talking to Paula Espinoso, who's an MP in the Valencian Parliament. She's with the Green Party, which is part of an opposition coalition. She spoke to me just a little earlier this evening from the centre of the city, which she told me is relatively unaffected, but she painted a grim picture of the situation facing people living in some areas south of the city, which have been badly hit.
People, they don't have light, neither water, regular water from in their houses. People are talking, people are doing social media. They are reporting that there are not really any help from the institutions.
So people, even tonight, are saying we don't have the help we need.
Let's say yes. Sounds really, really incredible that our neighbors, our colleagues, are saying that it seems that we are not in a European country anymore.
People don't have water, Paula. They don't. Where will people sleep?
Yes, and also there are some people saying that they are in the same building or in the same houses with people who are dead.
If we rewind a little, we've also heard a lot of people say they weren't given enough warning in the first place, that they didn't realise perhaps they should be packing bags and getting out. What are you hearing about that?
The Spanish National Meteorological Agency used the red alert some days before. The problem was that the Valencian government, even they knew, but the government didn't say, okay, you cannot go to work, you cannot do this, or it's better you stay at home. At 8 p.m., we had the alert. It was really late.
You represent the Greens. You're a Green politician. This is about climate change for you, presumably. What does this say to you and what needs to happen now?
We all are living, also in the UK, we are all living a climate change situation. In my opinion, there's no any government at this moment in the world in which we can say that we are adapted to this situation. I also think that there are so many things that the governments can do in advance to prevent the situations as we are living now in Valencia. Our infrastructures are not prepared for the upcoming situations. We are living here in the Mediterranean area, which we already know, thanks to the scientists, these catastrophes are going to happen. Not all the political parties want to talk in these terms. There are some politicians who are denying the climate change. There are some others who are not denying it. They don't want to spend money, and it's like this. They don't want to spend money on this adaptation. And I think this is something that could open the eyes to those who are denying climate change.
Paula Espinosa, a Green MP there in Valencia. Just to give you a pointer as to something coming up a little later.
I am Ada, the humanoid robot artist, and I create art to encourage discussion over new technologies.
Yes, we hear from and about Ada, the unlikely artist whose portrait of the computer pioneer Alan Turing has gone on sale at auction. Right now, though, we turn to the budget and the continuing fallout from that. One of yesterday's announcements was an extra £1.3 billion for local authorities, which includes £600 million for the costly issue of adult social care. The figure represents a 3.2% increase in funding in real terms for next year. But is that enough for councils facing surging demand for social care, homeless provision and services for children with SEND, as it's known, special educational needs and disabilities? Since 2020, six councils, Slough, Croydon, Thurrock, Woking, Birmingham City and Nottingham City, have issued Section 114 notices, equivalent to a bankruptcy. Just yesterday, Nottinghamshire County Council warned it faced a funding shortfall of as much as £76 million in the next 3 years. Conservative councillor Richard Jackson is the cabinet member for finance. I asked him what was putting the most pressure on his budget.
At the moment, particular concerns are around the amount of pressure in adults and child's social care. It's a national problem, but it's been added to by extra financial burdens that we've been passed down to us effectively in the Chancellor's budget yesterday. National living wage is the biggest pressure that came down to us yesterday. To give you an idea, the increase in 1 year on national living wage as a large employer will cost us around about £20 million. Now, our ability to raise council tax is limited. We could probably raise about £9 million additional council tax next year. So you can see already there's a significant growing pressure on us from yesterday's budget.
You have said you don't feel that Nottinghamshire is going to have to issue a Section 114. That's essentially a bankruptcy. How so?
Because we've made a lot of decisions and tough decisions early on, a lot of the councils that have been issuing Section 114 notices in recent years actually haven't done that. And the things that they've done after issuing those notices tend to be things that councils like us have been doing over the last few years. Difficult decisions and not always popular, but unfortunately they've been necessary. And I think we're seeing some of the benefits of that now. But we get to the point at some point where something has to give, and additional shocks like the additional burden placed on us in yesterday's budget certainly don't help us.
Everything you've outlined, you know there will be people listening to you tonight who say councils are in this difficult situation because of what your government did over many years. Massive cuts from 2009-10 onwards, reduced council funding by 40%.
Yeah,
in real terms.
In response, of course, to their inheritance back in 2010 and austerity and the need to get the public finances back in shape back then. We can, as a local council, we can do the best that we can with the funding that we've got. We can make sure that our services are delivered as efficiently and effectively as possible. Actually, we took a huge amount of cost out of the council over the last 15 years or so, and at the same time been able to improve services. It's just that we've got to a point now where I think we've stretched what we could do in terms of efficiencies almost to breaking point. And funding needs to be looked at, and we need certainty going forward, and particularly need longer funding settlement periods as well, going back to 3-year funding settlements so that we can really plan effectively our services and our finances into the future.
Councillor Richard Jackson from Nottinghamshire County Council. Well, let's assess all of this more broadly with David Phillips, because he's head of local government finance at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. A very good evening.
Good evening, Jane.
Is it true to say that what we heard described there about Nottinghamshire County Council does actually broadly apply to a council wherever you live in the country?
Well, yes. I think one of the things that might surprise people that over the last 4 or 5 years, council's funding has actually gone up by a decent clip faster than overall economy-wide inflation. Between 2019 and this year, council funding is up about 9% per resident above economy-wide inflation. Now, it won't feel like that to councillors or many residents either, and that's because the demands and costs of many council services have been growing even faster than the high inflation we've all been feeling in our own pockets. So things like children's social care, adult social care, homelessness, and so on, big increases in costs there. So many councils are under pressure, despite already seeing some substantial increases over the last few years. Now, of course, that does follow a decade of austerity in the 2010s. And looking ahead, I think it's fair to say that the budget was perhaps more generous than councils were fearing for next year. But the Chancellor has penciled in some pretty tight figures for the years after that. She's not divvied it up between departments yet, but 26-27 onwards looks a lot less generous than 25-26.
Right, that's interesting. So in that case, that sum of 1.3 billion, longer term then, how much does that actually help?
Well, as I said, in the short term, there's 1.3 billion pounds of grant funding. There's perhaps about £1 billion coming from the producers of packaging and so on, what's called extended producer responsibilities. That will also help. When you add that £1 billion to that £1.3 billion and what looks like about 5% council tax increases in the coming year too, rather than that 3.2% figure you mentioned in the introduction, perhaps a 5% above inflation increase in council's overall funding in the coming year, that will certainly help. But unless the cost and demand pressures start to abate, a lot of that could be eaten up. And then in subsequent years, the overall spending totals penciled in by the Chancellor, just finding money for the NHS could absorb all of those. So finding additional money to top up council's budgets could be a real stretch indeed. And that means without even bigger council tax increases, 26, 27 onwards could be really, really difficult. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if at least a few more councils do find themselves pushed towards the financial edge, like Birmingham, like Nottingham City and so on. You know, it's a better budget than hoped for, but it won't solve all the problems.
David Phillips from the IFS, thanks so much. Well, one of the well-trailed measures in the budget was the adding of VAT to private school fees, which the Chancellor confirmed will apply from the next school term, starting in January. The government estimates it'll raise an extra £460 million to spend on state schools next year, rising to £1.7 billion by 2030. But the Independent Schools Council, which represents 1,400 private schools, most of those in the UK, has voted to press ahead with a legal challenge to the policy. Lord David Panett, KC, is to lead the case, which will be brought on behalf of parents. Let's talk about it with Julie Robinson, who is Chief Executive of the Independent Schools Council. A very good evening to you.
Good evening.
And so what is the basis of your case?
Well, throughout the debate on this policy, our focus has been on the children in our schools who are going to be negatively impacted by the policy, and that remains our focus. So we're aiming to defend the rights of families who have chosen independent education but may no longer be able to do so as a direct result of VAT on their fees.
Right, but you will know that the argument is only about 7% of all pupils in this country attend a private school. There might be people listening to this who hear the sums that Rachel Reeves says will be raised from this policy and say, well, I welcome that money going into the state sector.
Absolutely. We want to see more money going into the state sector. But I think we should remember that the government has a responsibility for 100% of children's education. And what we see in the sums is that this policy will, in fact, not raise meaningful amounts for the state sector, but will, in fact, cause disruption not only to independent school pupils, but also to state schools where children are displaced into an already stretched state sector. Many of the children in independent schools, over 100,000 of them, will have special needs and they won't be protected from VAT. So we're really worried about the net effect of this policy being a negative one.
I mean, before Labour were even elected, there was talk of this. There was talk that private schools would close down because of the impact of adding 20% onto fees. Is that happening? Is that really going to happen?
We are certainly going to see pupil numbers down. We're already seeing that. I'm afraid some schools will close. And over the coming few years, we're going to see a definitive change in the numbers and the structure of independent schooling. And over the timing of this policy, the government's been told by tax experts and teaching unions that a January implementation was too rushed. So, yes, it was trailed in advance, but we were expecting this at the beginning of an academic year if it were implemented, perhaps next September, not halfway through a school year. That's going to exacerbate the effect and the problems caused by this policy.
So if there was a sudden change and they said, OK, the government said, we'll delay it, we hear you, we'll delay it until there's a new academic year. I mean, how much would that change things for you?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear that. If there were a sudden change in the year?
Well, you talk about the fact that it's due to come in January in the middle of an
yes.
academic year. But if there was some relenting and the government said, OK, we will wait until the next academic year in September, in the long run, though, does that really change your argument? The 20% is still there.
It would make a huge difference, yes. If the government is intent on bringing in this policy, which they have seemed to be, they should give schools the opportunity to prepare. So this timing was announced during the summer holidays, and schools haven't been able to register in advance for VAT. So they've now got just a few weeks up until Christmas to prepare. They've got a lot of unanswered questions about how schools are going to cope with it. And also, parents, families have settled their children into their schools for this academic year. So they shouldn't be disrupted during the year. They shouldn't have to be looking for other schools potentially. It makes absolute sense to bring it in at the beginning of an academic year, and in the intervening time, it gives the government an opportunity to look at the genuine implications for this policy and perhaps carve out some more mitigations and concessions for the children who are going to be affected the most. Because most independent schools are very small. There are small faith schools, there are small specialist schools, special needs schools, single sex schools. They're going to be hit really, really hard. And we'd like the government to take some time to find mitigations for those.
Judy Robinson, we must leave it there. Thank you so much from the Independent Schools Council. Just to tell you that a Treasury spokesperson told the BBC that they don't comment on potential litigation matters. The US confirmed tonight that about 8,000 North Korean soldiers are now in the Kursk region of Russia. That's where Ukrainian troops have launched attacks designed to divert Russian forces away from Ukraine itself. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, told a press conference that they don't believe North Korean troops have deployed into combat yet against Ukrainian forces, but they expect that to happen in the coming days.
Russia has been training DPRK soldiers in artillery, UAVs, basic infantry operations, including trench clearing, indicating that they fully intend to use these forces in frontline operations. Should these troops engage in combat or combat support operations against Ukraine, they would become legitimate military targets.
Well, let's discuss this with Professor Michael Clark, visiting professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and of course, former Director General of the think tank RUSI. Professor Michael Clark, good to have you with us. Thank you. Do you think it is a given that these North Korean forces will eventually be on the front lines?
Well, Jane, it certainly looks like it, just given what we know about what they appear to be doing, according to South Korean intelligence and also NATO intelligence. I think the Americans' intelligence seems to have been a bit behind the curve on this. But what we know that they, or pretty sure they've been doing, is they've been training in offensive operations. So infantry training, working with artillery, working on trench clearing, working with UAVs. And we know that they've been divided, or we're told that they've been divided into platoons of about 30 with a translator and three Russian officers with each group of 30 men. Now, if you were using troops in a backup role, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't need to. So everything we know about what they've prepared for would indicate that they probably will be used in combat sometime fairly soon.
And crucially then, how much of a difference could it make?
Well, if they're used in Kursk, it would add, the number is 8,000, according to Tony Blinken, it would add 8,000 to the 50,000 that the Russians have already got in Kursk. The Ukrainians almost certainly have got fewer than half that. We think probably about 20,000, maybe 23, 25,000 at most. So the Ukrainians are under pressure. Putting another 8,000 onto the Russian total won't make a huge difference, but of course those numbers may go up. At some point, the Ukrainians are going to leave Kursk. They don't want to keep it. But when they're going to cash it in politically, the fact that they've been able to stay there since August and that they still control about 600 kilometres of it, they've had 900, they've lost 300, so they still sit on 600 kilometres. At some point, they're going to cash that in and withdraw. But if they're made to withdraw before they're ready to cash it in, before they can get anything out of it, then these North Korean numbers might make some difference.
Is it embarrassing for Russia to have to rely now on foreign fighters?
Oh, it's deeply embarrassing, particularly if they're used in Kursk, which is Russia proper. It's not that they're being used in a war against Ukraine. They're being used in a war in which Russian territory has been invaded, albeit a small part of it. So, yes, it's demeaning. Yes, it's embarrassing. And Putin is completely dependent anyway on 2 million artillery shells a year coming from Ukraine. He's completely dependent, from North Korea. He's completely dependent on drones and some ballistic missiles coming from Iran. He's completely dependent on dual-use technology is coming from China. But as demeaning as all that is, if it works, I don't think he'll mind too much about that. The fact is, though he's dependent on his friends and allies elsewhere, if he can just last the course a bit longer and the Western world is giving up on the war, which is what he assumes, then it may still work for him.
Professor Michael Clark, as ever, very many thanks. Thank you. Now, the government has settled for an undisclosed sum, a legal claim brought by the mother of a schoolgirl who died after an asthma attack in 2013 after being exposed to excessive air pollution in southeast London, where she lived close to the busy South Circular Road. 9-year-old Ella Adukisi Debra became the first person in the UK to have air pollution recognised as a factor in her death. Her mother, Rosamond, also received an apology from the government. It said it's truly sorry, and it's committed to delivering what it called an ambitious clean air strategy. Well, Rosamond Adukisi Debra joins me now. Thank you so much for being with us on The World Tonight. What does this settlement mean and this government apology? What does it mean to you?
Part of the big thing with the settlement, really, it was about the prevention of future death report, what the coroner asks the government to do, that at the moment they haven't done so. And for, obviously, my surviving children, I felt, and they were rightfully due an apology due to the trauma they went through. Obviously, they were with their sister on the night she passed away, and there were only five at the time. And I generally thought, when we managed to get air pollution on Ella's death certificate, I really thought they would take it seriously and actually do something, because we now know that air pollution is linked to so many non-communal diseases, you know, from cardiovascular, depression, strokes, respiratory, obviously, and especially when particulate matter was found in the placenta of pregnant women. And there was a lot of talk, but very little action. And so I decided to go down this route, because I could have stopped when I got air pollution on Ella's death certificate, but it became very clear that nothing was being done.
And you have campaigned so hard and you keep campaigning. Where do you go next? What more improvements do you want to see, though? Because there's still lots of children out there with asthma.
It is... Sadly, it's not just asthma, as I've just mentioned, and the burden of disease on the health service. And although Mr. Streeting says it is broken, and I heard him a few days ago talk about what he wants to do, I think, you know, if he cleaned up the air, not as many people would get ill, so less pressure on the NHS. And the chief medical officer, most people in health, I'm not going to say everyone because I don't know, agree that we need to have a preventative strategy. So obviously I can no longer help the likes of my daughter, but I can do something to improve public health. And I think also to the Chancellor, who obviously will be looking at the economy. Again, I'll say to her, I think there's about 2.4 million people who aren't able to work due to ill health. So again, cleaning up the air will prevent a sizable amount of people not getting ill. So it will be good for the economy.
Thank you so much, Rosamond. Yeah. I am so, so sorry to cut you off. We're very grateful that you could talk to us, and we wish all the best to your family. Thank you very much indeed. Rosamond Adukisi Debra there. Thank you. Now, finally, tonight we report, not infrequently, on works of art selling for large sums at auction. This evening, though, it's one with a difference. A portrait is up for auction of Alan Turing, the great mathematician and father of modern computing. And it's the first ever artwork made by a humanoid robot to be sold at Sotheby's. The robot is named Ada, yes, after Ada Lovelace. She paints. She also talks.
I am Ada, the humanoid robot artist. And I create art to encourage discussion over new technologies. I would like to tell you about my portrait series called AI God.
Well, can we call Ada an artist? I've been finding out more about the evolution of the technology from the robot's developer, Aidan Meller.
When SatNav came out, it didn't do a brilliant job. It didn't always take us where we wanted, and we didn't trust it. The algorithm took the data and it got better and better and better. And what happened is we wouldn't now go anywhere without SatNav. What happened is we transferred the agency of our decision-making onto the SatNav. We trusted it. What's happening with Ada is she's being given data and she's doing... But slowly but surely, she's taking more agency. So the thing that why Ada strikes everybody, because she's in a human form, she's making very clear what's actually happening societally, where we're actually transferring our decisions onto the machines. So when you go and do Spotify or do your music selection, it's getting better and better at telling the music that you like. And same with Ada.
In terms of the art world, though, yeah. where does inspiration come in with all of this? Because an artist will be inspired or informed by great artists of the past.
Sure.
Has she looked at the extraordinary flesh tones of a Lucian Freud portrait, for example, and said, oh, I'd take inspiration from that? How can that be created?
The data that she gets inputs from, she is able to work with to be able to then create her own works. So one of the things we did very strongly with the algorithms that were built specifically for her is we based it on Professor Margaret Bowden's definition of creativity. And that is, to be creative, she said, as a professor looking at this field, it has to be new, surprising, and of value. So what Ada does is new. The algorithm is built specifically for her. It's surprising. We don't quite know what she's going to do. We are looking over her shoulder as she paints. And of value, well, in light of the massive response that Ada's got in the 5 years of her existence, we know that people are really being challenged and questioning where all of this is going. And we hope that the artwork is able to do exactly that.
Should artists working today be worried by this? Are you going to put them out of a job?
There's absolutely going to be AI taking some of the artists' jobs. I think we just have to say that. It's very uncomfortable. AI is uncomfortable. And it's not just for the artists, it's for every industry here.
Yeah, but so where's the inspiration? This is the arts are for enriching us. We don't want a robot to write a play or direct a film, do we?
Let me tell you the thing that's really hit me being with a robot every day for the last 5 years. And it's the thing that I just would never have said when I began this project. What I've realized is not actually how human Ada is becoming. It's actually me clocking how robotic humans are. So when you talk about, oh, they're going to be taking their inspiration, of course they're going to be able to take in imagery like humans to be able then to do an output. So we are actually more robotic than we like to care to believe. And in actual fact, remember, people think that creativity has to be human. But if you go back and look at the history of art, go back to the Greeks, they said it was divine inspiration. It wasn't from the humans that created the art. It was a godlike thing. So in actual fact, the definition of art is continually changing. I think the dominant humanistic position is going to change as the algorithms are able to make those decisions.
Aidan Meller, the developer behind the robot artist Ada. The auction opens today and runs for a week. And if you're interested, you can see some images of that Alan Turing portrait on their website, adarobot.com. That's Ada spelt A-I-D-A. And that is The World Tonight for tonight. From me, Jane Hill, and everyone on the programme here, have a very good night.